Dave. Comedy, as we know, is full of hellfire and brimstone preachers who enjoy their work too much. You get stories of the fire and brimstone preacher with some sort of smart heckler in the back row having a go at them. So there was the one about the Northern Irish preacher. I'm told that this was Ian Paisley, but I've no idea what really happened. But apparently he was getting all worked up into a lather of excitement talking about hell and saying, you know, there will be a weeping and a wailing and a gnashing of teeth. And a little old lady in the audience piped up and said, I haven't got any teeth. So Mr. Paisley stormed back. Teeth will be provided. I don't know about that one. I saw it on TV. There was a preacher in real life. There was one in real life talking to a crowd of university students about hell and getting really into the swing of it with a long and extremely detailed story of how his aunt, in particular, had gone to hell. And one student who was sitting in the back row was getting a bit fed up with this and decided to very quietly sneak out. So the preacher pointed straight at him and said, and if you walk out of this place tonight, you too will go to hell. So the poor guy turned around and he said, you got any messages for your aunt? And the trouble is, it's not just bad jokes, is it? You know, you get individuals in real life who really seem to enjoy the prospect of other people going to the flames. You know, Jonah in the Bible is the classic example. You remember how Jonah went to the city of Nineveh, he preached to the people, they turned around, they changed their ways, they listened to what he said, so God did not destroy the city of Nineveh in the way that Jonah had warned. And then in the last chapter of the book of Jonah, we're treated to this scene where Jonah is sitting outside the city of Nineveh, sulking, because God didn't destroy the city. Didn't destroy the city and he's sulking. And when God comes and reasons with him, Jonah comes over all angry and says, I knew you were a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. Yeah, as though that is such a terrible thing for God to be. It's easy to have the heart of a Jonah. You think of Jesus' disciple in Luke's gospel. They're travelling, Jesus and his disciples, they're travelling down through Palestine. They come to the town of Samaria and the Samaritans won't let them in. So the disciples get worked up about this and they say, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to consume them? It's the heart of Jonah. But the heart of Abraham, we see here, the heart of Abraham is different. Now, Abraham, personally, he has reason himself to be annoyed with Sodom. Back in chapter 14, he went to great lengths. Now, true, it was for the benefit of his nephew, but it was for the advantage of Sodom as well. Abraham, with 300 and odd followers, fought off an invading army and rescued the people and the wealth of the city of Sodom and restored it. You know, brought the people home, restored the things that had been looted from their city. And then as you read chapter 14, Bera, the king of Sodom, you would expect him to be, oh, that is brilliant, thank you, Abraham. He's actually quite rude to Abraham when you read it. And you think, that's a bit off, coming from a guy who's just had his city rescued from some rampaging army. Now add to that, Abraham lived in the land that cried out under the evil of Sodom. In the same way that Jonah lived in the land that cried out under the evil of Nineveh. But then, down in verse 20, you have a look at it. When God unveils part of the plan to judge Sodom, is Abraham jumping with glee? There will be a weeping and a wailing and a gnashing of teeth. Straight away in verse 23, he puts in the plea for Sodom, and he seems to be trying to talk God out of it. Well, if that's Abraham's attitude, what about God? Is he looking forward to a bit of judgment and glad to be bringing on the fire and brimstone? Are we looking at a Jonah God who needs to be talked out of judgment by the Abrahams of this world? And us? How do we talk? How do we think about the whole judgment thing? In the New Testament, when Hebrews tells us that everyone has to die once and after death comes judgment, what are we supposed to do with that? Do we look at the evils of the world and think, oh good, they're going to get theirs? Now look at this carefully. But first, this Sodom in verse 16, what is this Sodom? And what have they been up to that is so evil? Well, the short answer to those two questions is, number one, we don't know, and number two, we don't know. Don't know what it is, don't know what they've been doing. There is a slightly longer answer. We don't exactly know where Sodom was. You go on the World Wide Web of Lies and claims to have found the ruins of Sodom. You know, someone saying, I have this little piece of brimstone that I plucked from the ruins of Sodom. That kind of thing. Claims of that sort, they're all over the web. They are up there with claims to have found bits of Noah's Ark or claims that NASA faked the moonwalks. You can find them. But back in the first century, Tacitus the Roman pointed to blackened and burnt out ruins in Palestine that had been singed, he said, by lightning. Or around about the same time, Strabo, the Greek geography man, talked about ruins of cities that you could see under the waters of the Dead Sea. About 2,000 years later in internet land, the chatter still goes on. But no one has yet found, you know, a rock from Palestine with an inscription on it saying, King Bera of Sodom was here. That hasn't turned up. But then, you think about it, that is actually the point. That is the point in Genesis. When God did destroy the cities, they were wiped out so thoroughly that the only thing of them that remained was the memory. All through the rest of the Bible, Sodom is the byword for being totally annihilated. Deuteronomy chapter 29. The whole land, brimstone and salt and a burnt out waste, unsown and growing nothing where no grass can sprout. An overthrow like that of Sodom and Gomorrah. There's that degree of wiping out. Now, we do know roughly where it was. We do know roughly where it was. Genesis chapter 14 places it in the valley of Siddim. That's great. Sodom was in Siddim. Then Genesis 14, because I don't know where the valley of Siddim is, so Genesis chapter 14 tells me that is the Salt Sea, what we call the Dead Sea, Valley of Siddim. Genesis 13 talks about it as being the Valley of the Jordan, like the Garden of the Lord. Beautiful place. Lush, fertile. Well, that is before the fire and the brimstone. And then in Genesis 18, our chapter, Abraham is encamped here at Hebron on a ridge overlooking the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea Valley, here it is, you know it is one of those rift valleys where the earth is tearing itself apart with salt and asphalt and things like that oozing out in abundance, all of which feature in connection with the town of Sodom. So maybe Sodom and the other towns were near the shores of the Dead Sea. And maybe in the time of Sodom it was a bit pleasanter than it is now. On the other hand, we know this entire southern part of the Dead Sea is only a few metres deep. They're very different from the much larger northern part, which is hundreds of metres deep. So maybe Strabo was right, and after the destruction of Sodom, the ruins were submerged in the new, shallower end of the Dead Sea. Oh, maybe. But Sodom, whatever the answer, Sodom was somewhere in that valley, and then after chapter 19, it was never there again. As for what they did that is so bad, that is not clear either. Which isn't surprising, because contrary to popular opinion, the Bible does not elaborate on other people's evil deeds. You notice that when you read it? You think about it. Most of the time in the prophets, God warns the people that they've done the wrong thing. They can fill in the details for themselves because they lived with it and they knew what they did. Same with Sodom. Now, okay, I was born in the UK, and the way I figure it, I know at least half a dozen abusive labels for homosexuality based on the word Sodom. You probably do as well. But that whole thing, Sodom, abusive labels for homosexuality, comes from the next chapter, where the two men from verse 22 go down into the city, and the men of Sodom try to pack rape them. But as you read it, the homosexual rape thing is only one component in the entire horrible scene from chapter 19. And then when you read on through the rest of the Bible, you get to Judges chapter 19. Israelites from the Israelite town of Gibeah try exactly the same stunt. But you don't. I don't see the Israelite town of Gibeah getting the same reputation and the same name in English English. You know, we don't have abusive words like a Gibeonite or something like that in English. It's not so much that Sodom was sort of hosting the Bronze Age Mardi Gras and that was why they got zotted. Their sex thing, as we see it, is seriously wrong. But in this instance, it's part of a power thing, and a violence thing, and an inhumanity thing that are seriously wrong too. It's just a small glimpse into the thorough vileness of their society. Genesis doesn't give us the details. Probably better that way. Rather, you get statements like verse 20, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave. That's all you need to know. Or in Ezekiel chapter 16, almost a throwaway line. This was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride. Surfeit of food. That is, too much. Prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and needy. They were haughty and did abominable things before me. Which makes it look like sort of decadent Bronze Age feudalism. You know, living off the fat of the land, squashing everyone in its path, surfeit of food and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and the needy. Well, that may be a little closer to home than Oxford Street. You know, no wonder that we take refuge in limiting the name of the town to the way that we think about homosexuality. But even with this dreadful reputation, look at Abraham's reaction when God drops the news. Look at it. In verse 21, all God says is, I will go down and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know. So you get the impression from verse 23 that Abraham already knows they have done according to the outcry that God has heard, and that God already knows that, and that Abraham already knows that God already knows. And Abraham has already guessed what God is going to do about it. You can tell that because the first one to raise the subject of judgment, you see it there in this chapter, the first person to raise the subject of judgment is Abraham. Verse 23. Abraham says, "Will you indeed sweep away?" See, that's it. Abraham knows. God is looking into the city of Sodom, and Abraham knows. There is no way that a town with pride, surfeit of food, and prosperous ease and doing abominable things, there's no way that a town like that is going to pass inspection. But the thing that bothers Abraham is something slightly different. The thing that bothers Abraham is the same as the thing that bothers your friend when they hear about judgment. It's the same thing that bothers you when you hear about judgment. Verse 23. "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked?" Verse 25. "Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just?" See, isn't that the thing? Isn't that the same thing that worries you when you read about Sodom, or when you read about the Israelites invading the land of Canaan, or any of those Old Testament stories? Isn't that the same thing that worries you when you think about God judging the human race? Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Feel the pain in Abraham's heart as he contemplates the thought of judgment. Feel the anxiety he has for those who are going to be on the receiving end, even in the town of Sodom. You know, this is a long way. It is a long way from the boneheaded happiness of the moronic preacher going on about fire and brimstone. The question is, does God feel that pain in his heart? Well, that's a question. See, Abraham has to argue him down, doesn't he? What about 50 righteous, 30 righteous, 10 righteous? Abraham has to beat God's numbers down. Or does he? Now, I've heard it often enough, and I imagine you have too, that what you read here is straight out of the Middle Eastern marketplace. You know, haggling over the price. God and Abraham bargain it down until they reach an agreed number of righteous that it will be okay to judge the city for. Now, you know that kind of bargaining. It's the sort of thing that you do when you go to Paddy's. And you haggle with the stall holders over little bits of fake jewellery or a pair of joggers that fell off the back of a truck that we won't mention. Or those electrical stores. Now, this drives me up the wall. Those electrical stores where they don't even put price tags on the things. So you have to make an offer, and then you argue it out with the sales assistant. Now, the sales guy needs to make a sale, but he needs to do it at a decent profit. So he latches on to you like a bad case of head lice until he's got what he wants. Now, I said, I was born in England, and I really hate that way of buying things. And I am congenitally bad at it. Yeah. I just do not get the thrill out of shopping. I don't want to play exciting games with the shop assistant and come away feeling as though I have scored a great win. I like to walk into a place, read the price tag, decide whether I want to pay that much, get the thing and go. Now, there you go. Male and English. Worst possible combination. But if you do like to bargain, if you like doing that kind of thing, you can learn the rules, you can play the game, and good luck to you. Enjoy. Sometimes I have found myself playing the game entirely by accident. There was one time Jenny and I were out car hunting. Now, they are the worst of the lot, car places. We found a car. We liked the mighty Camry it was. We tried it, we liked it, but we weren't sure. So the guy knocked $1,000 off the price. Now that was okay, but we had been car hunting all morning. We were hungry and in need of coffee. So I told the guy we would go and get something to eat and some coffee and we would think about it. We would come back. By which I meant we will go and get something to eat and some coffee and we'll think about it and we'll come back. But saying that was like when you accidentally scratch your ear at one of those art auctions, you know. He took it as a cue that we were bargaining, and he knocked another 1,000 off the price and threw in some extras. So we bought the Camry, and then we went and had coffee and something to eat. But is that what Abraham is up to? Is he pushing down the price with a reluctant God who wants to get on and judge? You know, is this like buying a microwave from Bing Lee? Well, watch out. When you are bargaining for a car or a microwave, where do you start? The sales guy starts with his highest price, doesn't he? You start with your lowest, don't you? You want to get him down as far as you can, so you start lower than you intend, and you let him talk you up while you talk him down, and you meet somewhere in the middle. You don't start the bidding with your highest price, do you? You start the bidding with your highest price, and the car guy will say, thank you, and take your money, and that's it. But Abraham, you look at it. Abraham does start off with his highest price. He starts with 50 and works down. You see that in verse 28 and 29? 50, 45, 40. It is not Bing Lee's. Something else is going on. So what is going on? Go back to Abraham's question in verse 23. Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Abraham is concerned. He is deeply concerned that if God judges the city, innocent people will get hurt. There will be what the Americans call collateral damage. So he doesn't start bargaining. He starts exploring. How arbitrary is God's justice? Will God destroy the city if there are people in it who don't deserve destroying? If so, how many righteous people will it take to stop God from doing it? So he starts his exploration at the high end. Now, because we have no ruins, because it was wiped out, we have no idea how big Sodom was. But these Canaanite cities, we know, did run into tens of thousands of people living in them. But out of tens of thousands, if there are 50, if there are 50 righteous people in the city, will God still wipe it out? And then we see whether God's heart is as pained as Abraham's. No. For 50, God will save the city. Now, very carefully, because he doesn't know where this will go, Abraham presses further. 45. How about 45? Or 40. And we go down in jumps of 10, 30, 20. Abraham isn't having to change God's mind here. He's just trying to feel for God's intentions. And then in verse 32... Abraham knows everything. Oh, let not the Lord be angry. Suppose 10 are found there. He answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. If God finds 10 righteous people in Sodom, he will spare the entire city. Will God sweep away the righteous with the wicked? No, he won't. Will the judge of all the earth do what is just? Yes, he will. It really doesn't seem like a big ask, does it? Just 10? God answers Abraham's question, and he answers ours. But he answers other questions too. You know, when you read through the rest of the Old Testament and cities get destroyed under terrible circumstances, and sometimes we read, sometimes that is God's judgment. And if your heart is like Abraham's heart, you ask, is that right? Is it okay for Jericho to be wiped out by the invading Israelites? or Hazor, or the Canaanite towns of which Sodom was just one example, or the desert bandit tribe of the Amalekites that we read about in the books of Samuel. Before all of those events, before any of them happen, this story stands and casts its shadow. God will not, he will not sweep away the righteous with the wicked. And it goes even further. Judgment doesn't come easily to God. In Isaiah chapter 28, this marvellous little expression, in Isaiah 28, Isaiah calls judgment God's alien work. You know, not because God has to put on little antennium right around in a flying saucer to do it, but because judgment is, it's alien to God. It is not the thing he likes to do. It pains God even more than it pains Abraham. And where Abraham is grieved that the righteous might get swept away with the wicked, God goes even further. Unlike the moronic preacher, God isn't even anxious to sweep away the wicked. See, what is God's intention in choosing Abraham in the first place? Now think about it. We've had it the last few weeks as we've looked through the story of Abraham. Why does God choose Abraham and make promises to? It is to bless. It is to save. It ultimately to rescue human beings from judgment. Where do all the promises that God makes to Abraham find their ultimate fulfillment? In Jesus. And what was Jesus' ultimate purpose in coming into this world? What is the world's most well-known Bible verse? God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. That's most well-known, but you know you could wring 100 different changes on that from other less well-known verses. But that is the point. Saving people from judgment is God's great purpose. See, when God assessed Sodom for righteous people, what were the criteria for righteousness? In the Old Testament, for pagan towns like Sodom, the criteria that God used were usually pretty basic. Usually things that the people themselves would know were right or wrong. You take a look at the first couple of chapters of Amos, and you get the sort of thing. War crimes, wrong. Mercy, right. Not hard to work out. But there's a more fundamental judgment than Sodom. Hebrews chapter 9 talks about how we all have to face God. But suppose when it's your turn, God asks you very basic questions like, did you love your neighbour as yourself? Always. In every way. Let alone if God asks questions like, did you love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength? Always. Every day. It's not good, is it? But you don't want God to lower the bar either, do you? You don't want to live in a universe where God's golden standard becomes, did you love your neighbour a bit? Some of the time. When he was sort of nice to you. You want a moral universe where God is not going to put up with the city of Sodom. But judgment is God's alien work. He sent his Son to save. And he's made it as easy as it could be to be saved. John 3:16, whoever believes in him. To trust in Jesus and ask him to save you. It cannot get simpler than that. Judgment is God's alien work. He absolutely bends over backwards to save, as Abraham suspects and then confirms. So what do we do with Abraham and Sodom? With Abraham's desperate exploration of how far God will go with judgment. Well, two things. First this. 31 times in the Bible, this judgment of Sodom is brought up again as an instance of God bringing judgment on evil. Judgment so complete that not a trace is left. And every time the Bible brings it up, it's with the warning either stated outright or else implied, don't let that happen to you. Don't. God offers to save you. God holds out life to you. God gives his son to you. God holds out his hand to rescue you and lift you from judgment. That's where the heart of God is. So whatever you do, do not miss out on that. Take him up on it. Trust Jesus. Take God's hand. Ask him to save you. That's what God wants for you. And it must be what you want. When you hear of Sodom, make sure you've taken up God's offer to save. Second thing is this. If you're like those preachers who really love judgment and relish every gruesome detail about hell that you find in every medieval myth, if that is you, well, I don't know what to do for you. Just read your Bible and pray, I guess, and eventually God will sort you out. But if your heart is like the heart of Abraham, and judgment bothers you, if you ask, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? If you're there with Abraham asking the questions, what if there are 10 righteous? If that is you, then you have a glimpse into the heart of God too. If you don't want someone you know to go the way of Sodom, you know that God feels the same way, only to a degree so much greater that you cannot imagine it. How much greater? He sent his son into this world to die to save sinners. That much greater. So if your heart is like Abraham's heart, and a little bit like God's heart, what will you do? There's only one thing, isn't there? You support the mission of the gospel in every way you can. Here at home, away from here, as far as your hands and your resources can reach. You make sure your friends have every possible chance to put their trust in Jesus and be saved too. You pray for them. You tell them. You invite them. You do the whole gospel mission thing with them. Because like Abraham in his time, and more importantly, like God in Abraham's time, and like God in our time, you care about what happens.